A few days ago, the Los Angeles Times laid off 70 people, or 13% of the newspaper's editorial staff. And I always wonder, naively, when someone or some entity will say, you know what, we're not going to make our projected profit margin this year, and that's okay, we'll deal. I keep waiting for someone to stand up for journalism, to place accountability, reliability above earnings. I keep waiting for a Bill Bradley or a Mark Mulvoy or Gloria Steinem to return from another age, enter the newsroom and bellow, it's our time. It is our time. Sadly, it's 2023. And in the wake of another round of layoffs, it doesn't quite feel like it's our time. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Michael Bamberger, my former Sports Illustrated colleague, a veteran golf writer, and the author of a new book, The Ball in the Air, A Golfing Adventure. This is episode number 315. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Michael Bamberger, we have not seen each other in a long time. All right, here are the three things I think about with you. Number one, I was at a Braves game with you, and I was blown away because you knew the guitarist for REM. I think maybe he had done the national anthem or something, and he came over, and you're like, hey, Jeff, this is blah, blah, blah. He's from REM. And I'm like, whoa, what? Do you remember this?
I do remember that. And it happens to be the bassist for REM named Mike Mills. And he's an absolutely great person. And he's a seam head and a golf nut. So I get to see him in those capacities and some other ones. You have it absolutely right. He did sing the national anthem that day and the house was empty.
Number two is you said to me something that haunts me to this day in media, which is we're in Atlanta, and I think I was probably staying in like the Comfort Inn, you know, or something, or a Holiday Inn. And you go, when I'm on the road, I feel like I should be as comfortable as I am as when I'm at home. And SI at the time, you could stay at really nice hotels and they would not really call you on it. And I sort of learned from you, I swear to God, no more Quality Inns for me. And it really was this. So you were actually right at the time. I was the idiot being like, nah, I'm going to be the good soldier and stay at this $70 a night Comfort Inn. And back in the day, that was kind of the way at SI, you could stay at lovely hotels.
Jeb, that is true. And, I'm not on the road nearly as much as I used to be. I definitely have had years where I've had 100 nights or more in a hotel. And just so you know, because you'll find it interesting, I actually got that phrase from Peter Carey, the number two editor when I got hired, and maybe when you did too, Jeff.
Yeah.
And he said when I joined the magazine, we expect you to be as comfortable on the road as you are at home. I was not one to abuse it, but I do believe that. And it can be different. That's just funny that you say Atlanta. So I was staying at the Ritz-Carlton in downtown Atlanta, and a friend of mine, Brian Roberts, who now runs Comcast NBC Universal, he happened to be there too. He said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm staying here. He said, yeah, that's the problem with Time Inc. Michael Bamberger staying at the Ritz-Carlton. He said, if I was running it, you guys wouldn't be staying anywhere like this. So just one little quick note about that. But SI back in the day and Time Inc. back in the day, there was a woman, Nina Prado. I'm sure you remember.
Of course.
She was the bean counter. And my wife and I went and covered Tour de France. And then, of course, at the end, you're staying in Paris where the race concludes. And she literally said, if I should ever be covering Tour de France again, I needed to spend more on my hotel because I was going to make it hard for the next person. In other words, you know, I lowered the standard, like you saying at that Comfort Inn. So a very different day. And you may have had this experience, Jeff. If you go on the Wikipedia site for Time Inc., the first words are, and this is stunning, Time Inc. was. You just can't believe a company that was that great could be past tense.
I was talking with John Wertheim, our former colleague, and number one, when I told him I was having you on, he was like, this is what he remembered. I swear to God, I think it's nice to hear these things sometimes. He remembered. So John, myself, and Grant Wall, sadly, the late Grant Wall, we were all promoted at the same time together.
Well, you, John, and Grant Wall all went from what, senior staff writer to senior writer?
No, We went from reporter to staff writer to writer, reporter to senior writer.
Wow.
Yeah. And we would always get promoted at the same time. And I always felt like, you know, those guys were like, this is going to sound dumb. I always, at SI, as a University of Delaware grad, I always fancied myself as like the blue collar kid, you know, a lot of,
I think that's a great quality of yours, but I do know that.
And, but we were always promoted. And when we, the first time we were in, you know, they would do the State of Sports Illustrated sort of Christmas annual. They'd fly everyone in and they'd have this meeting. And John remembered this vividly. He said, we were in the meeting. We didn't really know people. You kind of, when you're first in the meeting, you're first there, you're first invited, you feel like you don't belong and you're looking around and there's Riley and there's Gary Smith and whoever, Phil Taylor and Richard Hoffer and all these guys. And he said, you went up to all three of us and said, hey, I'm Mike Bamberger. Congrats. 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 And he always remembered that very fondly.
That's nice. I appreciate you saying that.
But that being said, the other reason I remember you, like my other story I remember is I had formed a very good bond as the inside baseball columnist with our fellow Jew, Sean Green. And that was my guy. Sean Green was my guy. I wrote the first thing about Sean Green in SI and it was called The Kosher Kid. I did this whole thing. And they're like, we want to do a profile on Sean Green. And I'm like, great. And they said, we're giving it to Bamberger. And I'm like, what?
But in that same period, do you remember there was a kid from a Talmud? I'm sorry, not the right word. A yeshiva, a small Jewish day school in Baltimore.
Of course.
Who was good. And he was like.
The Jewish Jordan.
And I wrote him up. And of course. If you're at a high school basketball court where like the rim is 9'8" and he's like the only person over 6 feet, of course he's going to look better than he is. And to this day, that piece kind of, he was a great kid, but he had the tzitzit flowing and the yarmulke falling off his head. And the question was, if he went to Maryland, would he play on Friday nights and could he get rabbinical dispensation?
Wait, his name was Tamir Goodman.
Oh, you're good.
Mike, not only that, he went to Maryland and everyone's like, whoa, this guy's going to Maryland. This guy's going to Maryland. Gary Williams, the coach, recruits him. He shows up. He's a University of Delaware basketball player. He was just not at that level. He got eaten up. But then he moved to Israel and had this basketball career. So, you know, good for Tamir Goodman.
Good for you for knowing all that.
Since we're on this like nostalgia tour here, which I just love and could do for an hour, what's your lowest moment at Sports Illustrated? What's your lowest editing moment, your lowest, like, oh, Jesus Christ moment?
I covered lacrosse once without, I covered cricket once without understanding anything about it. Same thing happened with lacrosse. Same thing really happened with Tour de France. But with Tour de France, you know, to your point, you said you had Sean Green when you're writing baseball notes. You know, to me, the key to being a beat writer is, it's great to have rich, wide array of sources, of course. But if you've got one guy that you can really, really go to again and again and again, who really knows what he's talking about, there's so much to be said for that. So during this Tour de France that I was covering, without knowing anything about Tour de France, for Sports Illustrated, which was a weekly magazine devoted to sports for very sports-savvy readership, I was having my wife, Christine, and I were together. We were either meeting with, or I was meeting with, or having a meal with, often dinner, with Frankie Andreu, who was out that year. And he was giving me an insider's guide to how Tour de France works. And that was very helpful just in terms of me trying to understand and cover it. But, and this is definitely the regret, he said, you can't compete at this level without doing something. I said, what does that mean? It means 100% of the cyclists are doing something. And, you know, I feel like I blew it figuratively blew it, because had I gone down that rabbit hole, which is what we do as reporters, like you have a hunch, you hear something, and then you check it out. I think the story was very gettable. And then it was years later until, and I remember telling my friends that who were really into cycling, he said, oh, they were just innocent fans. They said, oh, there's got to be a lot of clean athletes. I said, I'm just telling you what this guy said, but I never pursued it, and I should have. So that's a real regret. Have you had something like that, Jeff?
I mean, I look back at baseball, and, you know, we all sit there and we all go, well, we didn't know. Like, that's the thing. Well, we didn't know. And it's like, it's sort of our job to know. When you see these guys and all of a sudden they're enormous, like the Maguire-Sosa year, everyone's like, oh, it was at the time. Oh, this is a magical run. This is amazing. Some of us should have had the wherewithal to at least start asking the questions. And none of us did. And I just find that a little bit, I get it's not easy. I get it's maybe it wasn't as obvious as it should have been, but our job is to figure this shit out. Like, it just kind of is. So when it's too good to be true and this stuff is happening and we all just buy into the miracle, I feel like we kind of failed to do our job a little bit.
I completely agree. And I agree even in that specific. So in 90, I was covering the Phillies, and let me think here, Lenny Dykstra maybe came to the Phillies. Yeah, he would have come to the Phillies that year. He was way bigger than he was before. And the question is, how'd you get big? And he said, yeah, these special vitamins, wink, wink. But he was admitting then, and I didn't go down that that path. So I know what you're saying very well. Just one quick bit. So I covered some of that Sosa McGuire summer and had that same experience, isn't this magical? And of course, our impulse to become sports writers in the first place is we like sports, and probably most of us said we love sports, but we're also, as you know, we hope serious reporters, open-eyed about it. So like sometimes this push and pull between love of the sport and celebrating its achievements and then looking at it at a clear-eyed way are in very clear conflict. And I think that happened very much there. So I remember covering Sosa, you know, there was this watch, and I'm sure, Jeff, you were much more intimately involved in it, but at Sports Illustrated those days, it was like there was a chance a guy might set a record. We had people there. At one point, I was at Chicago covering Sosa. This is weird, but I know it's true. I wound up in Sosa's apartment. And Jeff, I know you've had this experience a million times. It's like, can you really recreate how it happened? I don't know. I know I wound up in Sosa's apartment because he was expecting a baby, and they had wallpaper in the, whatever they call that, you know, the infant's room. And it was Yankee pinstripe wallpaper. It's like, that's really odd for a guy who plays for the Cubs. But anyway, so the Cubs played a lot of afternoon games then. And Dave Anderson, the late columnist for the New York Times, so he was a buddy of mine. We sat next to each other, different things, because of alphabetical seating. He drove me to O'Hare after the game, and it was getting late. And either Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur was beginning that night, so I had to get on a certain flight. And I remember Dave saying, yeah, I'm nervous if I don't get you to this flight, and you're late for the cold entry service in Yom Kippur. And he was a devout Catholic. It's going to be on me. How about for you, Jeff? What would be an example of that push and pull? You had it with Sosa, McGuire, and what will be other times when you've had it?
Oh, man. When I was covering Bonds, it was just so obvious, and I feel like I didn't even – this is a great one. Richard Hoffer wrote the cover story about Bonds. I'm Barry Bonds, and you're not. He then didn't speak to SI for years because of that. I got the first sit-down with Bonds. He agreed to talk to SI because we had a mutual friend – who sort of served as an intermediary. I sat down with Bonds. This is when he was enormous, physically enormous. And I don't think I asked him one question about it. Not one question about it. I was just young and dumb and didn't ask. And it's, you know, I'm not haunted by it, but I look back and think that sucks.
But also you're going to lose the guy if you ask it.
Maybe you ask at the end.
You can ask it. Yeah, exactly. That's the oldest trick in the book. You wait for the brain. I wonder what year Hoffa wrote that piece. For those, have you had Hoffa on your podcast?
I haven't. I think about 92 or 93 he wrote that. That's I hated Bonds. Bonds. Wait, who's your least favorite athlete you ever covered? Who's the
I had a little run-in with Bonds. I was just gonna mention that because I'm a little confused about the years now. The Giants are playing good baseball, and I went in to cover a 3-game series. And I think they must have still been definitely they were at Candlestick, and Dusty Baker was the manager. And you know, Jeff, you've had this experience a lot. You go into the clubhouse, and you're trying to see who you know and who you might talk to, and you're sort of making the rounds. And Bonds calls me over, and he would not know me. He could maybe recognize my face, but I doubt even that. But when he was in Pittsburgh and I was in Philadelphia, certainly quote covered him, meaning I was around him when he gave group press conferences. So he calls me and he says, who are you with? And I said, who are you? I said, Michael Bamberger, Sports Illustrated. What are you doing? I said, you know, you guys are covering a 3-game series here. And he was polite, not polite, but he was fine. And then so I went around and did my business. Rod Beck was a closer on the team, because I remember talking to Rod Beck a little bit after that.
Yeah.
And then could some of this next part be hyperbolic over the years? Yes. But my memory is that he stood on the stool. Now, that's not likely, but I'm just telling you my memory. But this next part is probably very close to accurate. Yo, Mr. SI man, would you mind interviewing somebody or getting the fuck out of this clubhouse now? Now, Jeff's been around forever. That happens. And you just take it on the chin. But it's going to make your job a little harder because now you've got, you know, 24 other guys watching. So Dusty Baker heard it. He was in his manager's office. He called me and he said, what the fuck was that about? He said, you must have some bad history with this guy. I said, I really don't. He said, well, don't worry about it. You do your job and, you know, I'll try to figure out what's going on here. So Dusty Baker, who is, you know, I think the mensch of mensches.
All time.
He said, yeah, I talked to Bonds. And now this is my memory, what he said. There was a father-son Bonds story in SI from years earlier. Barry and Bobby and the son hated the story and by extension hated it. Sports Illustrated. He didn't mention Hoffer, not that I recall at all. He mentioned his father-son story and he won't have anything to do, but he said, you know, you just do your job for the weekend, give him a wide berth and you'll be fine. It showed so much about the kind of person Dusty Baker is.
I just want to say, it reminded me of the time I was in the Seattle Mariners clubhouse and they had a pitcher named Ryan Franklin. And the guy, he sat next to another pitcher named Arthur Rhodes in the clubhouse.
Oh, I remember Arthur Rhodes.
So I sit down next to Ryan Franklin in a chair and it's Arthur Rhodes' chair, but he's not there. And Arthur Rhodes is walking on the other side of the clubhouse and he sees me.
Holy Jeff, you sat in Arthur Rhodes' chair?
Yeah. And he screams at me, get the fuck out of my chair. In those moments when you're like getting yelled at by Bonds or getting yelled at by Arthur Rhodes in a clubhouse where you are the nerd and they're all the cool kids, there's nothing worse.
But in fairness, he was correct.
Why?
Because you got writer cooties, man. You can't get
that's your writer. That's true. I didn't think of that. That's fair.
No, they always speak about the unwritten rule or what they call it, you know, the unwritten rules of baseball. That is one of them. You don't sit in the chair.
Yeah. Well, we all make
it. Did you ever do it again?
Not Arthur Rhodes' chair, at least. You need someone to invite you to sit down. Basically, what you need is someone to invite you and say, hey, take a seat. And then it's okay. Otherwise, you can't do it. What's your worst chew out of all time from an athlete?
Oh, wow. Many. But the first one that came to mind was Roger McDowell, who was as nice as a ball player could be. And McDowell said to me one day, yeah, you ripped us last night. Meaning, you know, the story you wrote last night for that day's paper. I said, what do you mean? He said, yeah, you said you were loafing. I said, no, I didn't say that. Yeah, you did. I said, did you read the story? He said, I don't need to. And he walked away. You know? It was kind of a lesson because often it really doesn't matter what you write. They know what you wrote, even if they don't know what you wrote. And you got to live with that reality. Like, you're not turning anybody around ever. Like, I've covered Tiger since he's a teenager. And Tiger's fine with me in the sense that if I ask Tiger a question in a group press conference, which is all I ever do and all pretty much anybody does, if he likes the question, he's great. If he doesn't like the question, he politely blows you off. But Tiger has no use for me. I know people well that know Tiger well who would vouch for me. It doesn't matter. You're not turning people around. I mean, you can maybe over time, but it's not a common thing.
Do you care if the golfers like you? I know the automatic journalistic answer is no, I don't care, but I don't know. Do you kind of care if the golfers like you? Do you want them to like you?
I remember it's going back to the Inquirer newsroom again. I think the writer was a woman named Susan Fitzgerald. We sat in an area of the newsroom in the Inquirer building that was known as the Country Club. It was called the Country Club because like we were cordoned off from the main part of the newsroom. We could play Nerf basketball for an hour and nobody would ever catch us goofing off. But anyway, phone rang. She's nodding. And then she looks ashen-faced when she got off, and she had written a profile of a mobster's wife. So everyone's looking at her face, and it's like, oh, God, this could be really bad. Like, you know, look out for the dead horse kind of thing. And somebody else says, well, you know, what was that about? Is everything okay? And she was really kind of down. She says, yeah, the mobster's wife liked the story. You did something wrong if the mobster's wife liked the story. I don't need them to like me. This is a cliche, of course. Most people like to be liked. But what we do, we're not in the, oh, please like me business. If you are, you should be in another business because this is not our business. But, and this is a very significant but, they should think, whomever you're covering, they should think that this guy's going to give me, this person's going to give me a fair shake, however you respect, wherever you want to say it. I think that is a very significant difference. And I've gotten better at this as I've gotten older because, Jeff, I'm just old enough to have grown up on the legend of Woodward and Bernstein and like, gonna get the man, sick to the man. And I came up with that, you know, and then college newspapers, of course, there's a lot of that. But then you get older, and this is me getting on a soapbox, so I'll make this very brief. But when I was young, I used to think, or if I go to a class and talking to young reporters, what's the single most important quality for a reporter? I'll pose the question to you, Jeff. What is the single most important quality for a reporter?
I would say curiosity.
For the first 30-odd years of my reporting career, I would have said curiosity.
Okay.
And then only recently, curiosity has gone down to number two. And then I have a new number one thing that is the and it kind of gets to the sling of, you know, like versus, you know, being respected. My number one thing now would be empathy. So I think that is really the single best starting point to being a reporter. What's it like to be that person?
100,000,000%, yes. And not only that, the weird thing about this all is, and I bet you would agree with me on this, when you are younger, you are not very empathetic and you get a buzz off of, maybe you didn't, I certainly did, finding the warts, finding the flaws and sort of digging into those and burrowing into those. And then as you get older, you're like, this is a real person I'm writing about. This person has pain. Even if I don't like this person, like John Rocker in a way is a great example. In a lot of ways, that story really sucks. Because there's no example of him. I forgot who said, oh, it was Russell Baker who wrote in Growing Up something about, wouldn't it be ideal if every time you write about a villain, you have a scene where he bends down and smells a rose. And what that John Rocker story lacked was him bending down and smelling a rose. Because everyone has those moments. You just have to find them. And when I was a younger writer, I had no interest in looking for them.
Well, that's a beautiful image from Baker. He was one of my heroes growing up. It's funny, his name doesn't come up much in conversation. Another guy like that, Jeff, you might not even know this name. I know you would know the name Willie Geist from TV. But would you have ever known about his father, Bill Geist?
Sure, of course.
You would have. But many would not. But Bill Geist was, he was really a Russell Baker type reporter writer who could see the human and the humorous things in everyday life. But in addition to Rocker bending down to, you know, to smell the rose, I think now maybe you'd say, well, how did this guy get so fucked up in the first place?
Right.
So here's 600 words about how John Rocker grew up. The language that he used with you, the coarse, vulgar, disrespectful language that he used, it came from somewhere. It didn't come from nowhere. If you're more in touch with the empathy gene, then you really want that part of the story. And you say, look, I need another 800 words to explain this.
Wait, I love this because it's very easy to say Barry Bonds is an asshole. It's much harder to try to figure out why he became an asshole.
Yeah.
But much more interesting.
And I think that was, you know, you have this with your books, of course. And this is what we had at Sports Illustrated, especially, Jeff, for you in your later years. And I was lucky enough to have this from the beginning. Spend enough time with the subject to actually really get to know them, period. And that's why if you think, you know, the great DeFord profiles, even the great Dan Jenkins profiles, and definitely Gary Smith and Rick Riley and Hoffer and, you know, Scott Price and various others that we could cite here, they just did that. They spent enough time. So even if you reread, let's say, Riley on Marge Schott, she's not just a cartoon. She's a broken woman. Well, how'd she get broken? Well, I'm not going to say Riley goes deep on it, but it is there.
You have a new book out. I said, oh, you got a new book out. It's called The Ball in the Air, A Golfing Adventure. And it came out March 28th, Avid Reader Press. I said something about, you know, this probably won't be the most glamorous podcast. And you're like, ugh, I haven't been that many. Coming out with a book in 2023 is a fucking beast. Do you hate the process of promoting a book?
I would hate it more if I was doing any of it. Jeff and I have a mutual friend and colleague, Alan Shipnuck, and Shipnuck, let's see, this would have been about 2015. And he was very kindly doing kind of the role that you're doing here. You know, he was interviewing me about a book that came out. And then I remember this so clearly. Alan said, writing a book is such a grind. Why do you bother? It was such a deep truth that I had been avoiding for so long. But I know you have this experience. It's just, you know, I mean, you've written short. I've written short. We've written medium, long, and books. And I'll put the question to you, but you can already tell where my answer is, which is the most satisfying for you.
Books.
You know, they get read by the fewest people.
Yeah.
You know, John Rocker was read by literally millions of people.
Right. None of my books have been read by millions of people.
Even the big, big bestsellers wouldn't be read by a million people.
So why do we do this shit?
It feels good. I don't. The process is hard and it's challenging and it's exciting and it's a mental challenge. And, you know, the only thing we have at our disposal is the ability to report the story and write the story. It's really primitive. And then it's like, you know, what's a good vocabulary? 5,000 words, whatever it is. You know, so we go through what you know, those few vocabulary words we have in our head, and we put them down. And you know, the idea that you got this thing in your head and then you're going to transmit it through your fingers onto a laptop or whatever and get it out to the world. I get a thrill out of it. I get more of a thrill out of it now than I did when I wrote my first book in 1986, and I love that experience. So I guess it's a good feeling, but. How do you, Jeff, how do you distinguish between the books that do well commercially and the books that don't, the books that you have deep emotional bond for and those they have less of a bond for?
Your book is about golf. It's about amateur golf. And I've never taken that leap that you actually sort of take with this book, which is a book like that has to catch a wave to sell well. You're not hitching it to Tiger. You're not hitching it to Phil like Alan's last book. Every book I've written, except for the USFL to a certain degree, has been attached to a big, like I'm working on a Tupac biography now. Well, that's attached to Tupac. My last book was Bo Jackson. That's attached to Bo Jackson. It's not my name selling the book. It's the topic selling the book. A book like The Ball in the Air, it could sell well, but you have to catch a real wave. And I think that's really hard.
It is hard. Now, are you getting cooperation from Tupac's family and friends for this, or how's that going?
Friends, yes. Family, not so much so far. But okay, not terrible.
I don't think you've gone down that popular culture road before, have you?
You have, though. Wonderland is sincerely a great book, not just a good book, a great book. And I was going to ask you about it. Came out in 2004, a year in the life of a high school. I remember when it came out. I read it. I loved it. Also a weird topic in a way. Like, that was not a guaranteed sell. And it sold well, correct?
Honestly, at 63, I need to take a page from you, Jeff, and try to truly figure out where do my interests and the readership's interests match up. But of course, as you say, and I'm not trying to make a pun here, but you talk about, you know, riding a wave. Did you read the Finnegan book about surfing?
Barbarian? Yeah, I did, actually. Yeah.
I mean, who would guess? Now, of course, you know, this guy is a world-class talent, William Finnegan, Bill Finnegan. But who would guess an 800-page or whatever it is, 600-page tome about a guy traveling the world surfing would take off the way it did? But first off, the book's great. That's really the thing it's got going for it.
Or Seabiscuit or Boys in the Boat. Like, there are lightning in a bottle books.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if someone had told you Seabiscuit or Boys in the Boat, would you have been like, oh, yeah, I can see the commercial potential there?
No. I mean, my Walter Payton book, I think, came out right at the same time as Boys in the Boat. And I was like, Walter Payton, huge subject, right? Walter Payton and this book about a Olympic, you know, I mean, come on. And the thing just like skyrocketed to the top of the list. And I thought, oh, okay, there's hope for this business maybe.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my daughter, Casey, who recently decided she wants to be a sociology minor.
To quote the great New Jersey General Safety, Gary Barbaro, sociology is the key to an enlightened society.
I'm pretty sure Gary Barbaro never said that.
You're right, but I bet he shops at royalretros.com to buy old generals jerseys, hats, and t-shirts.
I guess, but what does that have to do with you being a sociology minor?
Oh, to be so uneducated.
Wait, I have another question. You wrote another book, which I did not remember you wrote, so don't be offended, but The Man Who Heard Voices. And I was like, whoa, where did this come from? Truly, I always butcher his last name, M. Night Shyamalan?
Yeah, you got it, Shyamalan.
Okay, and you wrote a book when he did the movie, The Lady in the Water. I'm so fascinated by this. I actually circled this, like, gotta ask this. What was the deal with that?
Yeah, I'm a movie buff. My wife and I go to the movies all the time. And Shyamalan lives in Philadelphia. I happen to meet Shyamalan. And I told him what I wanted to do. And he was really open and invited me in. And he was making this at the time. The thing about this M. Night Shyamalan is that he writes them, he produces them, He directs them, and I would even say he markets them, and he does it all outside of, very much in the Hollywood system, because, you know, he's got mainstream producers, but he's in Philadelphia on a farm basically the whole time. And he was a great subject, and he was very charismatic and an exciting person to be around. I really grew to be very fond of him. And he made this movie, Paul Giamatti. Now, almost everybody knows that name today, but his father was Bart Giamatti, who was the commissioner of baseball. It just so happens I knew Bart Giamatti and Paul when Paul was a kid, and Bart Giamatti was the president of Yale University. And I was a reporter on the Vineyard Gazette, and we lived right next door to each other. Anyway, so I asked Knight if I could hang out with him. And this is a little bit like your Peyton Manning thing. Like, this guy made The Sixth Sense. He made, other popular movies. And there was interest in this guy. But then this movie they made, and I never really understood the script. I never really understood how the movie was going to be good. But the guy who made the movie, M. Night Shyamalan, was very authentic in his desire to tell a story. Of course, he has an ego, like all Hollywood directors have an ego. But I feel like I wrote a really truthful account of who the person is. And it so happens the movie that he made was a colossal failure. It was like, oh, the book must be bullshit because the movie performed so poorly. And it's not true. The movie was weird and performed poorly. But it doesn't mean that he wasn't an authentic, creative person trying to make the movie. Anyway, a lot of good things came out of it, but that book just absolutely laid an egg.
But I'm fascinated by saying, all right, he cooperated. He was cool. You liked him, blah, blah, blah. You write a book. The book is called The Man Who Heard Voices, or How M. Night Shyamalan Risked His Career on a Fairy Tale and Lost. So when the book comes out and the movie's already, shit the bed, is he pissed off that you have this book that's saying risked his career on a fairy tale and lost? Is he like, what the fuck? I thought we were buddies.
The publisher in the paperback added those two words over my objection.
Wow.
And I said, you're going to sell 200 more copies of this book by adding ad lost. First off, I don't think it's true.
Right.
Of course, not everything we do works. You learn and you move on. I don't know, pissed or disappointed. I'm not sure what the right word is. But having spent hundreds and hundreds of hours with him and having him been really open with me, and then the book having that harsh title and then the movie not working, our relationship completely stalled and eventually evaporated. So, that's life in the big city. But, it disappoints me, but I understand it. He was mocked. He was making movies for Disney at the time, and they read that script. It's like, we don't get the script. Help us understand it. And Knight got the red ass and like, I'm going elsewhere. And he went to Warner Brothers. And people read that as, oh, what hubris that he would do such a thing. And that part of it got excerpted in Entertainment Weekly. And Knight feels that excerpt hurt the movie's performance. And I don't see how it could have helped. So
I just want to say, before your book comes out, M. Night does Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, Signs, The Village. That's all. Heavy duty foursome of movies. Your book comes out, Lady of the Water comes out, flops. His next movies are The Happening, The Last Airbender, After Earth, Wayward Pines, The Visit, Andra Day, Split Glass, Old, Knock at the Cabin. They now refer to it as the Bamberger Curse. That's what they refer to it as in the film industry. Now that I'm a Hollywood insider, I can tell you, they say, don't talk to Bamberger.
Yeah. It's a funny thing about the creative gene, it's different. The great novelists usually almost always do their work, their best work, their most creative, insightful work, before the age of, let's just say, 35. Or if you look at the Beatles, the emotion that the Beatles caught in the music they wrote when they were in their late 20s, you can see it in their early 30s, maybe. And you can really see it in the documentary, Get Back. It's astounding. But I feel like in our particular craft, the way we go about it, the reporting and the writing, and a lot of it, I think, does relate to the empathy gene and what you were saying, Jeff, that you develop it over time and over the years. I think you can get better and better at what we do, and you don't have to peak. How old are you now, Jeff?
I am a sturdy 51.
Yeah, you know, you don't have to peak at 51. You lose a few miles off of your fastball, but, you know, you get another pitch. And if you look at Roger Angel, I mean, he wrote a piece called This Old Man. You probably know it, Jeff. I mean, that's as good as anything could be. And he would have been well into his 80s when he wrote that, if not older than that. We're lucky that we can keep doing what we do if you love to do it. Jeff, let me ask you this. Riley was such a big figure. Have you had Riley on? Imagine
how. I have.
What impact did Riley have on you as a young reporter and writer when you were coming up at SI?
I think we all wanted to be Riley. And I think there's definitely an era at Sports Illustrated when I was coming up of mimicking certain writers, you know, and a lot of people are trying to be Gary Smith. I never had that gene in me. He's a great writer. That wasn't my sort of approach. And I always saw Riley was much more. This is not an insult to Riley because he's great. He felt more attainable. Like, I could not be Gary Smith. And I'm not saying I could be Rick Riley, but I liked his approach and sort of he had like a certain level of like blunt force to his writing that, you know, Gary Smith was very airy and light. I couldn't do that.
One of the things for me, for Riley, for those who don't know, if they're maybe too young to remember, he wrote the back column for Sports Illustrated for a long period of time. I don't know, well over 10 years, I would have thought. The economy of words and the respect that he showed for the reader, like the reader will figure it out. You don't have to over explain it. I really took a lot from that. And I feel like I've expressed this to Rick over the years. But, you know, we're the same age, basically. And but I really learned a lot from reading Riley. And I'm just really, you know, was very glad to have him as a colleague. And then I had a similar experience. So you were kind enough to remember Wonderland, the book about the high school. Just one quick note about that, which I think you'll find amusing. So the star of that book is a 17-year-old kid named Bob Costa. And it's called Wonderland because he tries to convince the singer who's just blowing up, John Mayer, to come and play his prom. But that Bob Costa, he was 17 then. Now he's in his mid-30s. Are you aware of this? He's now Robert Costa of CBS News. He co-wrote with Bob Woodward, the most recent Trump book that Woodward did with Bob. And, you know, he's either one of the leads or the lead political reporter and is, you know, still a great friend. But we met when he was 17 and did that book. But there's something I was going to say. Oh, yeah. So Wonderland. So Bob and I adapted Wonderland into a script, which we've, you know, never been able to sell. And then I worked very closely on it. Do you happen to know the actor David Morse, Jeff, by any chance? He played George Washington in the series called Adams. Paul Giamatti played John Adams. And so I sat at this table with David. Well, what should the character say next? You know, now we're adapting the book into a screenplay. We had a screenplay. We're trying to refine it. And then his question would always be, well, what would the character say next? And I think Riley had a lot of that. The beauty, have you done any adaptations from your own work or done any screenwriting at this point?
Yeah, I've done some screenwriting. Yeah.
And how's that gone for you?
I find it very hard. I love it. It's actually really fun, but it's very hard.
It's not easy. And Riley's thing, whether it had dialogue in or not, they were like little screenplays because there's what's really said is unsaid and the reader fills it in. And the reader's a really smart person. You know, that's got to be your starting point. And it's just a fun process for us. You know, what we've been able to do with our lives of, you know, keep at one thing, one narrow thing, try to be a better reporter and better writer and have the opportunity to learn every single day just by reading, period.
Wait, I have a final question for you. My favorite Michael Bamberger story of all time, which I told you about the other day, November 3rd, 1997, Sports Illustrated. We were both amazed that we could find it on the SI Vault, which is a travesty maze of, you know, if someone were on acid and trying to get through a like a Halloween corn maze, they might have better luck than trying to find an article in the SI Vault. But it's called Joy Took a Backseat. The author never knew why a fellow writer ruined his year on the Dream Beat. And we're going back to the mid-90s. You're at the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're plucked from the news desk to call the Phillies. And the Delaware County Times, there's a Delaware County Times, had a beat writer, Bill Brown, who treated you like absolute shit, like just rode you hard, like the meanest older fraternity guy to a pledge. And you wrote this really long It's a piece that would never run nowadays. I don't even know where that would appear nowadays, but it's so good. It's basically about your misery on the beat that year. And then Brown dies and you go and you sort of interview his family about who he was and why he treated you this way. Every time I see the word brio, not joking, for years, including today, I think of that story because you use the word brio in a Philly story and he mocked you for it. Did that story, tracking down his family after he died, sort of understanding who he was, give you any peace in the whole, mess of it all?
I think that piece is what we try to do. Now, that one happens to be intensely personal. You know, like, he wouldn't get in an elevator with me. If you were at an airport, you know, reporters are always sharing cabs, going to the same Marriott. He wouldn't get in a cab with me. You know, I couldn't really understand why. Because my thing is, you know, try to treat people decently until they give you a reason to not be treated decently. And even then, I'm going to get. So he never kind of really gave me that. And he was very good at his job. He really understood baseball, which I didn't. And he really understood the culture of the team. And he really understood his readership. So, yeah, it was the same impulse that we have for everything that we do. You know, who's Tupac? Who's Walter Payton? What can I learn and share? So it's that same impulse. What can I learn and share? It just happens to be one that is very intense because it's so personal. And what I found from that piece, and it's amazing how often it does sort of come up, not that it's an everyday thing at all, because it's certainly not that, but it turns out that everybody has a Bill Brown in their life where you can't figure out why they treat you the way that they did. Or it could be a boyfriend or girlfriend who breaks up with you and you never really sort of have your moment of, well, why didn't it work out? A lot of people aren't equipped for that. They're not built. That's not even fair. They're not built for that. But I am. I want to try to figure it out. And so that's what I did in that piece. And I appreciate that you remember.
So the two other writers, it's funny, were George King and Paul Hagan. They kind of ran as a trio. Bill Brown, Paul Hagan, George King, covering the Phillies at the same time you were. And I was kind of wondering, when that story comes out, do either Hagan or King sort of ever say, hey, sorry about that, we were kind of dicks to you?
No. I think in George's case, and he was similar to Bill. I mean, is George still on the beat today? I haven't seen his byline for a while now. But no, George was like, I knew you were a dick and this piece proves it. And Hagan, I don't recall ever, a response from Hagan one way or the other. But you know, I respect that. You know, they were a band of brothers and they were going to stand up for each other to the end. It sort of goes to what we were saying earlier. It's like, you never really turn around anybody on anything. You know, I could have Fred Couples call Tiger Woods and say, you know, you ought to get this Bamberger another shot. That's never happening. And even if he did, nothing's going to change. But that doesn't mean we can't try. And that doesn't mean, you know, we're writing for readers always, you know, and I know that you have the same impulse. Our boss is our readers, full stop. So the hardest thing about the way the business has changed since you and I started in it, like, that was such an obvious starting point. You put the reader first. If you don't put the reader first, everything else falls off. As we know that in the search for clicks or the search for advertising support, sponsored, blah, 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 that's getting lost. And that's a tragedy.
I agree 100%. Well, we didn't talk about your book much, but I don't really care because I love talking journalism. I love this stuff so much.
People say this all the time, but it really is neat to be with you. And it has been years and years, but literally picking up, or figuratively picking up, right where we left off. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank today's guest, Michael Bamberger, for joining me on Two Riders Slinging Yang. You can buy The Ball in the Air, A Golfing Adventure, wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Slinging Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.